Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So this morning, we have another aspect of AI and human personhood. And perhaps an aspect we haven't yet talked about, at least not in a focused way, namely the spiritual aspect of the person that is free will, or free choices. Now, I'm not going to give you a complete account of free will here, according to Thomas Aquinas. That would be a talk of its own. But there is something important here that we will consider in the context of AI. And of course, it does affect then what is the image and likeness of God in us, the spiritual rational center, as John Paul II would say, or the free inner core of the person, the free inner core of the person, right? So the place where we can freely relate to what is happening to us. Now, in that regard, artificial intelligence has become increasingly sophisticated in predicting human choices. And prediction is always a precondition for manipulation. And that is not just in this case, that is generally true. Early modern science developed mechanical models of the universe and mathematical laws of nature because it helped to accurately predict what things do under certain circumstances, and then you can build machines based on it. And that means you can manipulate nature and also subject it to your purposes. So that is not, in principle, new. Likewise, even earlier it has been observed that if we try to subject nature by these mechanisms of predictability, eventually that will include us. It will include human nature. And Adorno and Horkheimer and the Dialectics of the Enlightenment will very much make that point. And that in some way, the subject of manipulation, that us trying to manipulate nature, will become the object of that manipulation as well. And Adorno and Horkheimer thought about things like advertisement and propaganda, which they had experienced particularly under fascism, but also that they saw in the capitalist world in a commercial sense. And that is pretty much still what we are dealing with when we're looking at AI and what is being produced there in these ways. But again, that is not entirely new. And almost everyone seemed to agree about that in the early 20th century. So Frederick Skinner, for example, is another example, who was a behaviorist, famously, and so therefore thought that you could condition human behavior. And he wrote a novel, Walden 2, alluding to the title of Thoreau's book, which he thought was a utopia, where some enlightened kind of technocrats manipulate people and condition people to be just good, right? And, of course, you can always ask who's conditioning the conditioners, you know? But he didn't see that as a dystopia, but a utopia. Regardless how you evaluate, people did think, in that time especially, that our abilities to do so have grown very large. The same Adorno I quoted earlier, who is a bit more of a left-wing figure, agreed with Oswald Spengler, who is typically more on the right-wing spectrum of things. He has an essay on Oswald Spengler in which he criticizes him, but he agreeingly quotes one passage from Spengler that goes like this. Once upon a time, one could hardly dare to think freely. Now, we may do so, but we have lost our ability to do so. Now only one wants to think what one ought to want to think. And precisely this is experienced as freedom. Now, Schwenger thought here about the newspapers and journalists and what they can do to manipulate the mobs on the street. But in a way, that is still very much what we have. So we have, we go along with the crowd, we go along with what the algorithms suggest to us, and precisely experience that as if it were our own free choice. And so what is going on when we are manipulated that way? I'll come to that. Again, this is not entirely new. It's important to see that too. There has always been propaganda. The ancient Greeks knew about propaganda. Machiavelli knew about propaganda. There's also the so-called Panopticon by Jeremy Bentham. That was designed for prisons, but you find often in the imagination of sci-fi movies and so forth that have precisely to do with AI surveillance. So if you are surrounded by screens in which you can, you know, monitor the streets and facial recognition and things like that, that's the image there is exactly what Bentham had in mind. So it's a prison system where you have a tower in the middle of the prison, that you just need one guard, that's all that you need. And then radiating around that are the cells. And you can look into every cell. They cannot see you, right? But they don't know when they are being observed. And thus the the possibility of being observed makes them behave well. That is, the knowledge that somebody is looking at you and observing you or could be observing you manipulates your behavior, just that. And so does the surveillance, does people having data on you perhaps, or being able possibly to look at your data, does something to your behavior. And that's an idea that you find in the early 19th century, and again, for good reasons, continues into our contemporary imagination. Also in the 19th century, people discovered social statistics. And the algorithms that predict our behavior very much have to do with statistics and probabilities. But again, that is not entirely new. So in the time of Emil Durkheim, the sociologist, social statistics became a big topic, including statistics of crime. Now, a crime, by definition, is a free act. Otherwise, it's not a crime, right? And yet, it seems that you can predict the probability with which crimes occur. That seems to be raising questions about free will. How free are we really if you can predict that there's a likelihood that we will commit a crime? And again, these questions arise also with the information that people have on you with the algorithms and large language models. What do these probabilities mean about you? How free are you? So again, there is the antecedents for that, and it's good to look at the answers that people have given to these questions earlier. But first of all, just to remind ourselves, I mentioned that earlier, if there are crime statistics, and as I said, the judicial system, I didn't get to ask that question yesterday, but the judicial system can use algorithms to set bail based on the probability of you falling back into crime, then why could you not do also further things such as manipulating you in the same way that commercial algorithms do to be good, right? As Frederick Skinner wanted. If that is a possibility, if the statistics mean that you're not free, then why not using the same mechanism to re-socialize you by conditioning rather than putting you away in jail? So Walden 2 would indeed be a good possibility here. The ability to regulate behavior or to manipulate behavior has been documented in that Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. Who of you has seen that? Well, less than I thought. So it documents the behavior of people that are manipulated, but also sort of gives a little bit of a vision of the people behind the scenes that have sort of an algorithmic model of you and can push the buttons, you know, just crank the dial a little here and, you know, we'll do that and so forth and so on. And also the kind of ways in which people are addicted to these things. And they interview CEOs and also former CEOs of these companies. They quit their job because they thought they found there was something wrong with that, you know, doing that. So they had at least some good moral intuition here. And they also realized that they would never give their own children these kind of tools or let them be on Facebook because they knew exactly what it is going to do to them. So it works, but it is not a good idea that it works. Now, still, we have to ask, what does that say about our free will? What does that say about our freedom as persons in the image and likeness of God? Again, that worry is not new. We find some of that in St. Thomas Aquinas himself, but more explicitly among Spanish Jesuits in the 16th and 17th century. And here it is, interestingly, in the context of divine foreknowledge of free human acts. How does God predict our actions? How does he foreknow what we will do? It's eerie to think that, because if the algorithms do that, what do they aspire to do here, basically, right? The Christian God knows not just statistics, though, he does particular human acts. And that, too, is something we can do increasingly. I just read that Meta, that makes most of its money by advertisement, 97%, I think, now wants to craft advertisement individually by AI. So get in another kind of feedback loop where not only do they know what you like, but they can also craft the advertisement particular for you. So they will change the advertisement just to micro-target you. Some of the Jesuits thought that maybe what is God is doing. He knows under which circumstances you will choose the good, and so if you feed some grace into the soul, yeah, somebody will do the good thing. Now, that didn't quite work, and they also knew that in some way, I think. But it's odd, you know, that again is being mimicked somehow, but in this case not for grace and for the good, but in a way to tempt you. Advertisement is a form of temptation in many ways. So the Jesuits, though, that was the context, considered these kind of predictabilities and tried to explain them. And there were two paradigms that they developed. One is the inclination paradigm. And the other is a statistical paradigm. And there's a German scholar who has worked on this, a very thick book, what's in German, Knebel is his name if you're interested. But that's not very well known, but a very interesting kind of thing. So in the early modern age, people did already play through a lot of scenarios and ideas. So the inclination paradigm is can be illustrated with what you can predict a mother is going to do if you attack her child. Something in human nature that will spring into action at that point. And I'll come back to that kind of paradigm in a moment. The statistical paradigm can be explained on the model of rolling dice. And first of all, the sociological scenario here is, which they say, if you can predict that of 1,000 inhabitants of Madrid, at least one will commit a mortal sin in a given day. What happens if at 11:59 p.m., you know, 999 haven't committed a sin and maybe have moved out of the country or something, and you're the only one left? Must you commit a mortal sin? No, that's not what the statistics imply. And rather, it is more like the rolling of dice. So let's say you roll dice 1,000 times And that there's a certain statistical outcome to that. And one of them, one of the outcomes hasn't occurred after rolling it 999 times. Should you put all your money on that outcome? No, you know, you probably wouldn't, and you shouldn't. Why is that? The reason is that these dice are causally independent from each other. The previous rolls of the dice don't cause anything else in the subsequent ones. They're each of them on their own, if you want. Each of them remains unpredictable, even if collectively there's a probability for such an outcome. And that is indeed what then people suggest about human free actions. And so they make a distinction, it's a classical scholastic distinction between a collective and a distributive sense. So what applies to all in the collective sense is not necessarily what applies to each of the collection. The laws of the whole do not necessarily translate into the parts or the individual cases of that whole because there is no underlying mechanism to make it so. And so the set of all moral actions does not determine what happens in an individual case. And it's a little bit like quantum mechanics, right? I mean, so you have a statistical predictability for what's going to happen there. But what really is the case, the individual case, remains indeterminate until we actually observe it. And so there's an indetermination on the individual case in a distributive sense, and there is only regularity on the collective sense. Now, something similar can be found also in Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas Aquinas thinks that even in the state of grace, it is impossible for us to avoid every venial sin. So that may be a little bit surprising, but he says, so if you're in a, even if you're in a state of grace, it is impossible to avoid every venial sin. Unless you have a very special grace, like the Blessed Virgin Mary, or as he suggests, the apostles after Pentecost. But with ordinary grace, we can cannot avoid all venial sins collectively, but we can avoid each. So in each case, we remain free. Singly, we can avoid them, but not in the whole and in the collective sense. Statistically, we will fail in at least one case. And Aquinas suggests that if we are not in the state of grace, the same is true for mortal sins. That is, we can avoid each of them singly, but not collectively. And yet we are still responsible for our choices. We can be reprimanded for mortal sin, even if we're not in a state of grace and may want to claim we couldn't help it. Being in the state of mortal sin does not turn us into animals. We still have free will. And so we are still responsible. So there are statistical laws, but it may still be a question why they apply, for example, in this case of sin. And here one can come back to this inclination paradigm. That is, the underlying inclinations that may give us a certain kind of propensity. And these may be natural, but they can also especially be accentuated after the fall. So a fallen human nature predictably will also fall further. And we are wounded in our inclinations and we are wounded in our cognitive operations. And so this is not just a matter of weakness of will, Aquinas thinks. That is just generally true. And he says, and that's very interesting, so that he would make these very commonsensical human observations, that we are more prone to fall into sin if we are stressed, if we are tired, if we are multitasking, or if we are hit by surprise. You know, something comes to you at a surprise and you cannot think quickly enough, you know, then just your knee-jerk reflexes will come out and you act predictably in some or other sense. So all these things undermine our total attention and thereby that the alertness that would be necessary to avoid all venial sins. And, you know, we've heard about John Paul II, you know, there is this kind of alertness of the soul at the bottom that we can grow into, but that is never absolute. And so there can always be things that come by surprise or within stressed situations. And so we may end up going wrong. There's even a further suggestion that even apart from the fall, there are metaphysical reasons for why there are such statistics, and that even before the fall. And that is, there seems to be something about our finitude that lends itself to that. So Thomas Aquinas seems to suggest that because we are taken from nothingness, we are made, we are creatures and finite, that we have a propensity to go back towards nothingness, unless God keeps us by a special grace from that. And there is a kind of an inclination back to nothingness that leads to something like Murphy's Law. Whatever can go wrong will eventually go wrong. And Aquinas thinks that this is especially true if we have free will, more so than for other things. Because free will is, by its nature, very flexible and variable. I mean, there's the kind of sense of freedom, you know, that you can go in different kind of directions. And precisely because of that, it's more susceptible to go wrong eventually. If you want to speculate, that would mean that perhaps even if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, maybe the offspring eventually would have fallen into sin, that there would have been a fall in any case. But that's a theological speculation I leave to other people. But it's just to illustrate, you know, that there is something deep behind that that can make our actions predictable in that way. But it still doesn't mean, for Aquinas, that we don't have free will. So Aquinas does defend free will, but he is not entirely optimistic that we are going to use it well. And so this may be then underlying also some of the predictability of our action that can be exploited by modern algorithms. The learning algorithms just track certain statistical patterns. They don't ask questions or don't have any answers about underlying causalities. That's not what they're designed to do. They are just recognizing and exploiting these patterns. They don't need to know why they exist as long as they make us predictable. But we may want to know a little bit more of why they exist, and I gave you already some suggestions. For Thomas Aquinas, our will can be influenced in a number of ways, apart from what I just said. If you just think about the anthropology, so we have heard about, you know, the somatic features, there are emotional features, there are spiritual features. How do they all interact? How can my body or my brain influence my free will? For example, what if I have brain damage? So how does that affect my free will? For Thomas Aquinas, freedom requires knowledge. I am not free if I don't know what I am doing. It requires rational deliberation. It requires something like a cognitive object. A free choice is not something like a knee-jerk reflex that just happens, you know, opaquely and without me knowing about that or anticipating anything. I have something in mind that I consider, and based on that, I choose. And for Thomas Aquinas, it is this rational feature that makes us free in the first place, because it gives us all these particular things that we can use and do under the viewpoint of a universal good. Ultimately, that will be God. And we are indifferent with regard to these particulars, because the only thing that we necessarily want is the ultimate good. Now, that's another topic to consider. But first of all, just to explain why rationality is important for us to be free. We have to be consciously aware of what we are doing in order to make a free choice. And our brain cannot immediately influence our free will, but it may influence our thought processes. So I said earlier in the first talk that our brain is not the organ of our mind, of our intellect, because anything material would be particular, it wouldn't be universal. People typically think that because, you know, if you didn't have your coffee in the morning, you cannot think straight. You know? Or if you had too much wine in the evening, you know, your brain might be impaired in some way. And so why is that? Well, maybe because the brain is the organ of thought. No, that's not the conclusion. It is that the brain provides some necessary conditions for thought, but not sufficient conditions. The brain is necessary to process all the sensory data that come from the outside and are put together in some phantasm and so forth, in the internal senses, in the common sense, in the imagination and memory and so forth. And that gives the intellect something to think about. Right? So if you have a brain damage or you are drunk or on drugs, you know, your brain is being messed up and your phantasms won't go right and you cannot think straight, you cannot discursively reason from A to B to C, well, there is no good cognitive object that allows you to deliberate and therefore also not to choose based on that. So indirectly, your free will be affected by that. But it is indirectly. So for Thomas Aquinas, we are free insofar as we know. Our emotions can influence our choices, but only by indirectly maybe manipulating our knowledge and our actions of thought. And that goes in both directions. So reason is the interface between free will and the rest of who we are. Things in our body and otherwise cannot affect us except through the intellect. Otherwise, there is no free choice at all. But also, you cannot consciously will to feel something else than what you feel. You cannot will that away. You know? What you can do by your free will requires, again, the action of reason. So Thomas Aquinas, we don't have despotic power over our body, or maybe on physical motions, yes, but not, say, our emotions and things like that, but only a political power. And what he means by that is something like persuasion, a rhetorical kind of way of talking back to your emotions, to convince yourself, you know, that that's not a rational way of feeling and so forth. And so the will can use the mind to influence the emotions indirectly by the persuasive power of reason. And that's how cognitive behavioral therapy works. So this is all actually pretty commonsensical if you come to think of that. But I think it's good to recall that, you know, just to see how far freedom extends, what we can do with that, and how far also our freedom is in a way shielded from other influences. There can be extreme cases where we are so troubled and confused that we don't know what to do at all. In that case, by our will, we can still say, no, I'm not going to make a decision now. I suspend my decision. And that's often the most prudent thing to do. If you are in a troubled and confused state, you don't want to make life decisions, right? You better wait for a better moment and in the meanwhile say no to that. So, but there is a place for all of these things, including psychiatric treatment. So if there's a brain problem, yeah, I mean, you could use, you know, medication for that. There's also possibility for people breaking your will by, you know, by torture, for example, if that messes up your mind so much that you cannot really decide anymore in a rational way. So that concerns, you know, what's going on in us. And what is going on in us is also tied into a larger picture of laws of nature. So laws of nature are also predicting, and they can be used to manipulate, and they can also influence our mind, and in that sense, perhaps our free will. And Aquinas did not know about laws of nature in the sense that we have them today. That is, these mathematical laws of nature is something that developed in the 17th century. But he did have an analog. And that may sound at first a little strange. These are the celestial motions of the stars. And yes, there's a bit of a suggestion of astrology here. But in Aquinas' time, that was the best available science, because they thought these stars indeed move in a circular fashion, a very geometrical, deterministic kind of fashion, very predictable. You can make equations about that. And they have an influence on Earth, in the sublunar spheres, they call that. So here on Earth, he didn't think that worked with that mathematical precision, but it is still influenced by the movements of the stars. And, for example, it will operate on the humors in our bodies, which is why we have these different temperaments. So the phlegmatic temperament, the hysterical temperament, the melancholic temperament, and the sanguinic temperament. You know, it's the classical temperaments. And they correlated that with times in which you were born, for example. And so, now, without getting into astrology, is that really totally different from what we think about how laws of nature operate? We just take them from the macrocosmic level and put them on the microcosmic level, that is, underlying other things. So in our body, physical laws may be operating in some way or other, and they influence the physiology, including the hormones or something like that, and whatever else is going on in our brain, and that indeed may influence our behavior and our temperaments. That picture seems pretty rational to us too, and it is pretty analogous to what Aquinas taught here. And so and we have, you know, also temperaments, Myers-Briggs types and things like that. So this is not so alien to us. What should we think about these kind of influences with regard to our free will? St. Thomas Aquinas says, quoting an older saying, that the stars incline our will, but they do not necessitate it. Astra inclinant non necessitant. They incline, but they don't necessitate. They're not deterministic. And so again, we have an inclination paradigm here. We are inclined in a certain direction, but one that doesn't eliminate free will. Genetics, brain physiology, hormones, and the like can incline our will and make it predictable, but they do not necessitate our choices. They still have to influence, if they influence, they have to influence free will through the intellect. And so we can still rationally deliberate and take a stance and choose based on that. But that we have to do. And for that reason, Thomas Aquinas is not terribly optimistic that we will. Which means, yes, there will be predictability, right? So he says that only the wise man in the end will resist all these inclinations. Somebody who is wise does deliberate. He thinks long and hard about things. He takes a step back. He takes this universal viewpoint from which all these particular things can be relativized. And from that perspective, they can resist these inclinations, but Aquinas thinks there are few who will do that. The majority will go for the clickbait, if you want. After the fall, wisdom may be in short supply. And as I said, now natural instincts can be distorted at the same time, including our genetic inheritance, perhaps, the cultural environment, our previous choices. And all of these things make us predictable, and we are predictably exploited and manipulated then by surveillance capitalism, advertisement, electoral campaigns, and social media, and much else. It does work. Otherwise, people wouldn't invest a whole lot of money in that, from Amazon to Facebook. And none of that would have surprised St. Thomas Aquinas. Again, not all of that malign, if you want, in a way. Some of our predictabilities are good predictabilities, and that's actually an important distinction I want to say something on. Even before the fall, we would have been predictable, and even somebody who is wise will be predictable. Why? Because of human nature. There are certain inclinations that we have by our nature that make us predictable. For example, hunger. If you are hungry, the body correctly indicates to you that you need to eat, right? And all things being equal, that's the rational choice to make. So even somebody who is wise will choose to eat. Now, there can be reasons to the contrary, further reasons, say it is Lent, or you are fasting, or you're on a diet, or you know somebody who needs the food more than you do. And a wise person may have more reasons to choose these, because you deliberate perhaps in a wider kind of sense. But all things being equal, we don't need any further reasons to eat, because our nature is also rational, and it is rational to follow our nature. And we will do so freely. You can predict that even a wise person is going to eat, but that doesn't mean that he eats involuntarily or unfreely or by force or something like that. Predictability is not the opposite of freedom. It depends on the case, but in these cases, obviously, that is predictable. It's also predictable that the majority of the population will procreate. Priests and religious don't mess up that statistic very much. Contraception might, but generally that is what nature is meant to do, and that was what's going to happen, and that's not irrational, and it's also not involuntary. Some of these regularities are those that we develop ourselves. We acquire habits. So I talked earlier about skills, right? So skills are something you develop by practicing it, and then it becomes habitual. You don't have to deliberate about it or make free choices all the time. Let's say if you play tennis or piano, Professor Wales plays the piano, then you don't deliberate every time where to put the finger or how to swing the racket, right? If you do that, you're a very bad tennis player or piano player. Then you're a beginner, basically, right? You don't deliberate every step of the way. You have habitualized that by voluntarily practicing. That is, even if you do something by reflex by playing tennis, it doesn't mean that you play tennis involuntarily. I don't know how that would even work. The whole of your emotions is governed by your free will, the choice to play, and the choices that you made earlier to develop these skills. We play tennis freely, but our reflexes may be predictable. But it doesn't mean, again, that they are not free. In fact, some of these skills increase our freedom. So if I drive to school to teach, right, I have habitualized the way I'm driving, right? There's a particular route I'm taking. And that frees me from deliberating all the time where I make a turn or what's the best route to take and so forth. I don't have to think about that anymore. In the meanwhile, I can think about the philosophical theory that I will have to explain to my students in a few minutes after that. I'm free for more important things, right? Free for more important and more universal thoughts like a wise person would do. So it is habitual, but it's done freely, and it actually gives me more freedom for more important things. And yet, it is predictable. So if there were a terrorist or an assassin that wanted to kill me, right, he knew exactly where I would go, and hide in the bushes somewhere, with a rifle and could take me out. So that's not good, but it still doesn't mean that I'm not driving freely. Right? So the algorithms may be able to predict what you do, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you are not doing that freely. So predictability, statistical predictability, is not necessarily the same as determinism. Not necessarily, but it depends. So, but AI in any case can ambush you like the assassin in the bushes, right? So there's a whole swath of things that we do in this kind of habitualized kind of way. And the older we get, the more responsible we are for who we have become and our abilities, including, though, also the bad sides of us. We shouldn't forget those. We can develop vices, too, right? We can fail to inform ourselves, and then we are suffering from culpable ignorance, right? Right now, I may not be able to help that I don't know something, but I may still be responsible for not having built up to this moment in the past. The older we get, the more we grow, the more responsible we are for even the preconditions of our choices, because with that, we set sort of the parameters within which we choose. A child doesn't have that yet. That includes our moral habits. If Mother Teresa were alive today, I could easily predict that she would not attempt to murder me, you know, being on the wayside in the bushes to take me out or something like that, you know. Why? Because I know she is a virtuous person. She's a holy person, right? And she has developed the appropriate habits. But it doesn't mean that she is forced not to kill me, right? It means that she is more free because these habits made her free. They set her free. We are meant to be free for the good, but not. That is an important asymmetry. It's not the case for vices. So if you develop vices and addictions, that will undermine your freedom. That leads to compulsive behavior. And unfortunately, that is exactly the kind of thing that the algorithms play on. They play on our bad behavior, and they reinforce it. So a key driver for manipulation is our emotions. Facebook and other people will play on your emotions. They will appeal to your emotions. Not just that, they manipulate your bad emotions. Anger, resentment, envy, paranoia. Good stuff is never addictive. It's interesting, right? Think of all the news that you consume, right? I mean, you click on the catastrophes. Good news is no news, right? So if Mrs. Smith bakes a cake for Mrs. Meyer next door, that won't appear in the newspaper. She takes the cake and puts it in her face, that will be a headline in the local news next day, right? So, but that is where we are getting hooked. That is where we are less free. And that's exactly what those play with that want to manipulate us. And so if you look at the statistics of that, the algorithms and the patterns that they go along with, they don't distinguish these predictable behaviors. They're just interested in the statistics. For them, there's no difference between vice and virtue, between good habits and fallen inclinations. They all look alike from that perspective. But implicitly, it does make a difference because it shows what is addictive, and that shows statistically too. And these are the bad behaviors and bad emotions. They tend to bring out, therefore, the worst in us. And somebody has made the case that you can line up social media apps with the seven vices and deadly sins. So LinkedIn, greed, Instagram, pride, Facebook, envy, Twitter, wrath, Tinder, lust, Yelp, gluttony. It makes sense, doesn't it? You know? And so they specialize in capital vices, you know, and but never in virtues, interestingly, you know, even though both are forms of predictability, but they don't do the same thing. And so for us, that means the first response to that would be to take that wise step back and maybe not engage, even though they micro-target and tempt us in so many ways. To don't allow them to have that power over us and to develop the virtue that gives us the good habits. and therefore make us free. Now, that's often suggested, and it's true, and you should, but I think that cannot be the whole answer. I think that is a tremendously unfair thing to suggest to people. It depends on you and your virtue, what you do with your machines and devices. They are far smarter than you are. They know how to manipulate you in a way that no virtue can catch up with. And I think, here's a little bit a case for the Marxists. Unfortunately, they've gotten lost in action somewhere. I don't know. I don't hear from them anymore. But they tended to have a sense that you cannot just look at the individual. You have to look at the systemic kind of structure behind that and what it does to the individual, right? We are powerless in the face of some of these structural things. And that's not just Marx or something. I mean, for Aristotle, we are political animal, right? And so that means we are tied into this kind of larger whole. Or for John Paul II, that we participate in communion. But this communion is structured in many ways, institutionally, economically, technologically, and so forth. And so we have to address the structural kind of problems here, including, how are you, if you are just alone being up against the machines, you're going to lose. As I mentioned, Thomas Aquinas thinks that our free will is undermined by stress, tiredness, multitasking, and surprise. Well, how much of that do you get on a daily basis from your websites, right, and your Facebook site? You're stressed out because things come at you at a rapid pace. You're stressed because it's always the emotional and bad stuff. You have to multitask and respond all the time very quickly. You have no time to think. You're not the wise person taking that step back. And you are hit by surprises all the time. Multitasking is even seen as a virtue now and taught in schools. And Sherry Turkle says that itself is an addictive feature. It makes you feel good to do multitasking. Your brain tells you that's a good thing. And look how effective you are. But she says you can test that, and you're actually much less effective if you multitask. So we are tied into this kind of thing, and how are we going to develop virtue in the midst of that? How do we take that step back? I already mentioned earlier that even choices are often made by the machines for us, so we don't even learn to train that muscle to make prudent choices. So to appeal to wisdom and virtue may seem naive in the face of that, and so are there some things we can change about the setup of things? And I think Joan Lanier has some good suggestions there. So, for example, much of that is driven by economics. Advertisement. As I said, Meta makes 97% of its revenue from advertisement. That's what we use our smart machines for. Consume and pleasure and whatever else they give us. And that works because you yourself are the product. You don't pay for these devices because you're the product. You're selling yourself. Is that a necessary setup for using our machines and our algorithms? No, it is not. You can still use them for ill, like in China, surveillance of its own kind, but in a kind of market society, that seems to be the key driver. If you set it up in a different way, that namely, as you always paid for your newspaper, you can pay for these devices. You can put them behind paywalls, and then they shouldn't be allowed to exploit your data. They shouldn't be allowed to sell you and your relationships for advertisement. They make their money in other ways. That's a perfectly reasonable setup, and I don't see why a society couldn't decide to make it that way. We are still free enough to make these choices communally. Individually, that's much harder, but I think there's a political deliberation that is needed here as well. We may also think about putting, and that may be to a certain extent already possible, but putting the information that these people have about us into our own hands, right? So that we survey ourselves a little bit more, right? To become wiser by knowing how we have behaved on the internet in the past. I mean, certainly you could look at your history yourself, but if they have that fine-tuned knowledge about us, it may be interesting for us to know that ourselves. It may make us less manipulable, but it's good for us to lead an examined life, as Socrates calls that. That itself is a help to become more virtuous. Other ways in which we can do that. So these are just some suggestions. We can talk more about that, but I think I'm also running out of time. So I'll just finish here. So we, if we ourselves, in this case, get more of the information about ourselves, that could at least be a step, become wiser, and with that more free. And indeed, participate in a knowledge of us. Yes, if it mimics, you know, the knowledge of God, in some ways, I said, well, that's a knowledge we want to participate in. I think that's a knowledge that God would want us to have, you know, in order to become good people, wiser, and in that way also more free. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.